Going to open the Judicial Committee hearing today on House Bill 2492, House Bill 2493, House Bill 2494, 95, 96, 97, 98, and House Bill 2591. In the interest of efficiency, we're going to try and deal with House Bill 2492 and 2497 first, and then as we have time, House Bill 2493 and 2494 after that.
I've got
great. Okay. We're going to have an overview, I think, from two people. If I could have Gwen Dayton and Michael Crew come forward first. Give us your information on as many of those, or as certainly the first two, first four, and then we'll deal with others later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And with me today is Mike Crew, and I'll let Mike introduce himself before we get started.
My name is Mike Crew. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Cooney & Crew. We're General Counsel to the Oregon Medical Association.
I think what we've been directed to do this morning, and I hope it meets your needs, is to run through between Mike and I all of the bills that you have that are before you today and give a brief description of what they are, and both Mike and I are in support of the vast majority of the bills and give you some brief arguments of why we are in support. And then, as was indicated, focus continuing discussion on the four bills that are involve testimony by some who can't come again tomorrow. So with that, very briefly, before I start discussing the bills that Mike and I agreed that I would talk about with you today, the Hospital Association, as you know, is deeply concerned about escalating legal liability rates, both for physicians and for hospitals. You heard the testimony last week. I won't repeat it. But rates have been escalating dramatically to the point where they are beginning to impact access to care in Oregon's communities. They are impacting the ability of course, physicians to continue to maintain OB and other privileges, and some physicians are, in fact, leaving the state. Hospitals are concerned because their own rates have gone up by as much as 500%. But frankly, as important as that is their inability to recruit new physicians to come in to replace those who are leaving, because they physicians know that Oregon is on the list of states with a serious malpractice problem. And if they have other options, they'll choose them rather than come to the state of Oregon. And Oregon, as a consequence, its hospitals are facing a critical problem in providing the kind of care and the level of care that they want to provide to the members of their community and to your constituents. That is the crisis that brings us here today. It is not just a monetary crisis among providers, but really it is a crisis among your constituents and their ability to access care. But at the same time, as you well know, every person who has been injured, be it in a malpractice case or any other circumstance that causes them injury, and that injury may be the fault of someone else, they deserve to have access to a functioning court system that allows the full deliberation of their issue and an adequate compensation for the damages that they may have incurred due to the fault or negligence of someone else. So no one, certainly not the hospitals, is intending to propose reforms to our liability system that impact in any way someone's ability to have their day in court and have a legitimate day in court. With those comments, I will proceed to talk with you about House Bill 2492, 2493, and 2494, and why these bills fulfill that goal of increasing access to health care while maintaining access to the court system for legitimate plaintiffs. House Bill 2492 is the bill that amends Oregon's joint and several liability law to provide that each defendant shall be liable only for the defendant's own damages. The bill eliminates reallocation of liability among defendants if the court determines that all or part of a defendant's share of damages is uncollectible. Frankly, this change falls under the category of it's only fair. Previously, if a Hospital is a named plaintiff in a suit, and the jury awards damages to be paid by all defendants in the suit, including hospitals, and one or more other defendants are unable to pay for their share of the damages that are appropriate to their level of fault, then the hospital could be asked, or any other defendant, but I represent hospitals, could be asked to pick up that those damages owed, legitimately owed by other defendants, and that reflect fault that does not belong to the hospital. It's inappropriate for any defendant to be asked to pay damages that are only that have been attributed to another defendant for the fault caused by that other defendant. This is a popular idea. A majority of states have endorsed this change. And it aligns responsibility appropriately. It aligns responsibility with those who actually caused the harm, not with somebody who might just continue to have a deep pocket when other defendants do not. So the Hospital Association strongly supports that particular bill. Now, we've been told to run through these bills for some fair dispatch. I'm happy to take any questions as they come up, but if I don't hear any, I will continue to talk about the other bills that I have on my slate. Representative Williams, you're looking at me like I'm out of my mind.
No, you're not. You're not at all.
Okay.
We have one, and I'm going to ask you to be, because we want you to do just exactly as you've described. We do have a doctor who wants to testify who unfortunately has to fly back this afternoon or almost immediately back to someplace not here, and I don't know where actually. But we wanted to give him an opportunity to testify. What I'm going to ask both of you before you get into the bill by bill is if maybe you'd be willing to even just stay where you are, and I'll go ahead and bring Dr. Bowen up now. And he can sit in that center seat and give his testimony, and then we can excuse him from the hearing. Any objection to either of you?
No.
No objection at all.
Okay. Dr. Bowen, we'll accommodate you now so you can get back to your practice.
Thank you. I don't have to fly anywhere except to the office, but
okay.
I appreciate it, and I didn't want to disrupt the proceedings in this way. I can reschedule and actually have, but thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to express my concern about the malpractice crisis of the state, which really deals with the whole nation as well. My name is Michael Bowen. I'm an obstetrician-gynecologist. I've been practicing in Salem for 11 years now. I chose not to speak extemporaneously for fear that I would eliminate many things that I would want to say and would not do a good job of it and be clear and succinct. Therefore, I sat down last night and wrote out what I'd like to say. I found this morning that the purpose of this hearing is specifically to deal with certain bills, and I'm not really prepared to give testimony on specifics, and I would beg the committee's indulgence to allow me to more or less read my prepared statement. May I do so?
Yes, please.
Thank you. This crisis has been characterized as a malpractice problem by those whose interests lie in having the public believe that a few bad doctors are injuring and killing their patients, when the truth is far different. I canceled my office last Monday and Tuesday afternoon in order to sit through both sides of the hearings in this room. Therefore, I know that you are aware that the majority of cases by far that are filed are dropped because the plaintiff's attorney realizes there is no case. As you're aware, and you are aware, that the majority of cases that do go to trial are found in favor of the defense. In those cases, our current system works. However, other cases are settled for some lesser dollar amount, not because of an admission of guilt, but out of fear of an astronomical verdict that can and does exceed the coverage by the doctor, and therefore leave him or her open to losing everything he or she has. Then there are the cases that are the real problem, not just for doctors, but in the long run for all citizens who need and deserve good health care. Those cases that go to trial and huge multimillion-dollar judgments are given in virtually every case because a jury felt empathy for the injured patient and wanted to give them millions of dollars, which after all just comes from some big rich insurance company, or so the jury is led to believe. Juries are not even allowed to be told the limits of a doctor's insurance policy. They think that a doctor doesn't have to pay any of it, that the insurance company will cover it no matter how much the value. Perhaps one might say that I exaggerate or am biased when I say that in virtually all of these big verdicts, there is no malpractice committed. Trust me, in every one of these cases, the facts and the science is gone over with a fine-tooth comb by the defense, and if there is any legitimate error, either in judgment or action, these will never go to trial. They will be settled. Jurors have been polled, including one recently in our own community, and they routinely admit they could not understand the testimony, and in fact were bored by it, and simply decided the case based upon their feelings. And there is not much that elicits more sympathy than a bad baby outcome. And that's why we who deliver babies are at the center of this concern. It's an unfortunate fact of life that bad things happen, even to good people, and even to their babies. In times past, when Americans took more personal responsibility, bad outcomes were accepted as either an accident, bad luck, or even as God's will. But today, the public expectation is perfection. If anything turns out less than perfect, it's someone's fault. And if it's someone's fault, then you should be able to sue him or her. And maybe if you get the right jury, you can deal with your sorrow more effectively with $10 million or so. It is this lottery mentality that has led us to this crisis. Now, I'm not so naive as to think that errors have not been made. Errors in judgment, errors in diagnosis, and very minor surgical errors that could have adverse consequences. Of course these things happen. Of course I have made errors. Every doctor has. But in what other profession is one not allowed any margin of error at all? Where else is any bad outcome automatically assumed to be malpractice and worthy of a large judgment? Unfortunately, or fortunately, human beings are all just a little bit different. We respond to disease differently, trauma differently, medicines differently. And we as doctors are human also, and sometimes have to make life and death decisions and operate, and yes, even deliver babies under circumstances where perhaps we haven't had any sleep the night before. But society says that does not matter. You'd still better do it perfectly. The medical profession in this country is the envy of the world. We're better trained, better educated, have access to better medicines, procedures, and equipment than anywhere in the world and than any other time in history. But the citizens of this state and this country are going to wake up one morning and find that there's no one, at least no one with expertise, to deliver their babies, to do their emergency surgeries, or perhaps even to render basic medical care. In the last few years, of the OBGYNs in this community alone, there have been 6 retirements. 4 more have left to practice elsewhere. 1 more is leaving to practice in California at the end of this week, as a matter of fact. I hear the malpractice climate is better in California, as you have too. 4 have quit doing obstetrics in order to do gynecology only. And 2 are even changing professions. Much to our chagrin, they are going to law school. True. Those of us that are left are getting very tired of looking at every patient that walks into the office as a potential lawsuit. Instead of being able to create a mutual trust with my patients, I instead spend more time documenting everything that I have discussed with a patient, which takes away from time spent giving patient care in order to protect myself if any bad outcome arises. I order more expensive lab tests and studies and hospitalize patients earlier and more often, not for better care, but to protect myself should any problems arise. Even doing that, of course, problems and complications still occur. And I live every day wondering if that letter is coming from the plaintiff's lawyer requesting records. I went through 5 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 4 more years of intensive residency training, working 80 hours a week at less than minimum wage in order to care for patients, to try to make a difference in their lives, work with them to solve health problems, some of them serious, even life-threatening. and share in the usually joyous experience of bringing new life into this world. I currently work 60 to 70 hours a week routinely, have many nights with little or no sleep, sacrifice a social life, family life, miss my children's games and concerts, but I chose this life because I felt the rewards of being a meaningful part of my patients' lives was well worth it. I made a very comfortable living as a chemical engineer for 7 years, but chose to take 8 years of my life to just prepare to practice medicine, to operate, and to deliver babies. I did not do this to find myself looking over my shoulder constantly, to not be able to use my knowledge and training in a way that I felt was best and most optimal for patient care. I did not do this so that my judgment and every move could be second-guessed by a greedy plaintiff lawyer and a jury that is selected not for their ability to weigh medical testimony and render a fair and just verdict, but rather for their perceived tendency to be swayed by emotion. And that, in the end, is pretty much all that the plaintiff lawyer has to win his case when it comes before a jury, and that's emotion. I regret to say that I have apparently made a bad career decision to go into medicine, and unfortunately, I'm too old to make another such career change. Therefore, I, like many of my colleagues, will be looking at retirement very soon unless meaningful, underline meaningful, tort reform is enacted. This will obviously intensify the problem of patient access to care in this community and throughout the state and throughout the nation if the number of retirements occur that are anticipated. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are a number of good bills before you that have been introduced regarding tort reform. The most important by far is the cap on non-economic damages, pain and suffering. Since only about 43% of any award on average goes to the injured patient, it is obvious why plaintiff lawyers are against any caps. Our present system is broken. It's worse than useless. It leaves a small fraction of patients that experienced adverse outcomes with reimbursement for their medical bills and legitimate other expenses. A select few win the lottery, and the vast majority of patients that have bad outcomes get no help at all for even their medical bills, and sometimes are left destitute. Where is the plaintiff lawyer's compassion for these people? Why are they not pushing for some sort of no-fault compensation fund to which doctors can contribute in lieu of exorbitant malpractice premiums? I think the answer to that is obvious. There is no money in that. You see, they don't really care about the patients. And what it really amounts to is that apparently it's only the doctors that really care about their patients. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would ask that you who represent these patients, who are your constituents, would care enough about them to move this legislation through the committee and advocate for this legislation among your colleagues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bowen. Are there questions for Dr. Bowen? Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one quick question?
Yes, sir. Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, how long after a baby is delivered do you have perceived liability or, well, no, it's not perceived. It's legal liability for any poor outcomes that may occur. I've heard 5 years. I've also heard 18 years. Can you help me with that?
I'm afraid that I really can't answer that specifically. My impression is that the potential is there for discovery up until age 18. I may be wrong on that. I don't profess to know the details of that, but if an injury is supposedly not discovered by that period of time and it's discovered way down the line, a suit could still be brought. In other words, if, you know, the rather exaggerated example is if your kid doesn't get into Harvard, you know, sue the doctor that delivered. That's obviously a stretch, but if something could be discovered down the road, you might still be liable in a court of law.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else?
I have a copy of my testimony.
Yeah, that's fine. If you just give it to the committee assistant, it'll get distributed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Gwen, we're ready to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Very briefly, on House Bill 2492, I was describing the bill in our position. And in summary, the Hospital Association strongly supports this bill because it promotes a fair distribution of damages. Damages are paid only by those who actually caused them and not on behalf of others. And it discourages the practice of naming a deep pocket defendant to a lawsuit solely because so you'll have somebody there to pay the damages apportioned to others who may not be able to pay the damages or from whom the damages might be uncollectible. The Hospital Association also supports House Bill 2493. 2493 provides that an expert witness may testify about scientific, technical, or other specialized areas of knowledge only if the witness testimony is based on sufficient facts or data, the testimony is the product of reliable principles and methods, and the witness has applied principles and methods reliably to facts or data on which the testimony is based. We note that this bill applies to defendants and plaintiffs alike. It prevents either side from going to trial with all the expense that is associated with that, with experts who are not able to provide meaningful and fair testimony that is helpful to the jury in making their determination. We hope that a provision like this, one, will allow the jury to make a fully informed decision and a fair decision to both parties, but it will also encourage settlement because no party will be able to proceed to trial with inadequate expert testimony, simply hoping for the best or hoping that perhaps the sympathetic facts may speak for themselves and their expert testimony does not necessarily need to support the argument for damages paid by the defendants. So we see this as promoting access to health care because it will promote settlement of cases and promote fair resolution of cases. And we see this as supporting the plaintiff's continuing ability to go to court and promote a legitimate claim because the defendant as well is expected to have to present qualified expert testimony. Before I move on, can I answer any questions about that?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Yeah, my question would be at what point and who would make the determination if testimony was scientifically based?
The court would need to make that determination.
Representative Chitterly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Gwen, I don't do any trial work anymore, and I don't recall cases that I actually had to use an expert in the work that I did. But isn't this all basically the foundational determination that a court makes already in determining to, if a question is raised as the foundation? Aren't these just the points that a court already makes determination on?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, certainly these are foundational questions. They are not contained in the law currently. Mr. Crew, who does more trial work than I do, may be able to elaborate.
As a general proposition, any time expert testimony, particularly scientific expert testimony, is proffered, the court should make a determination before it is put to the jury because of the nature of the testimony and its ability to persuade lay jurors. And that fact was recognized in State versus O'Key. And I might point out that the bill, 2493, is simply an attempt to bring the Oregon Rules of Evidence, Rule 702, in line with the federal rule of evidence 702, and there they apply the so-called Daubert rule. And I might add that there's a gentleman here today to testify, Mr. Jonathan Hoffman, who was involved in a case, Jennings versus Baxter Healthcare, which I think can give you a great deal of information how the rules are currently applied and what the outcome can be if scientific evidence, and I'll put quotes around scientific evidence, is allowed to go to the jury without it being first tested by the court. But as a general proposition, the rule now is, and currently, I don't believe that the rule as written necessarily changes the way in which the court would approach the admission of scientific evidence as we speak today. I think what the attempt here is to make it clear that the court should apply the rule and be certain that the evidence that's coming in is indeed based upon some form of science in the sense of tested, peer-reviewed, published, that sort of thing.
Further questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Could you give me, I'm kind of lost or maybe missing, give me an example of what kind of evidence wouldn't fit that a judge would allow?
Well, actually, if I could beg off and have Mr. Hoffman,
okay,
when he testifies, I'm sure he can give you a number of examples.
Great, thank you.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So did I just want to make sure that I heard correctly, because I had actually written down a question here with regards to whether testimony was best practices based or evidence based. And what if I heard you correctly, it's not necessarily based on information that is even peer reviewed, so it wouldn't necessarily be either best practices or evidence based.
Well, under the so-called Daubert case, one of the tests that was mentioned by the U.S. Supreme Court is whether or not the testimony that is to be put to the jury is in fact based upon some sort of body of peer reviewed science,
okay,
as opposed to that which is not peer reviewed.
Okay.
It's just one of the tests. I might add that the court in Jennings versus Baxter Healthcare in Oregon, in fact, said that is not necessarily a basis to exclude the testimony, that the fact that it's not been peer-reviewed.
Thank you.
Okay. Proceed, please.
Thank you. The final bill that I have on my list to testify about is House Bill 2494, which is a bill that requires written notice before trial of the identity of any expert witnesses to be used at trial by either party. Parties to civil litigation must disclose the identity of any expert witness who will testify and provide a written report regarding data or other information to be considered by the witness in forming an opinion, any exhibits to be used, the qualifications of the witnesses and compensation, if any, of the witness, and there are time frames to be followed in providing this notice. The point of this bill is so that both sides, and this applies again to both sides to any litigation, have adequate notice as to what experts will testify in support of a case. We don't want trial by ambush. That doesn't serve anyone. Both parties should be given an opportunity to appropriately settle a case before trial. If there is, in fact, strong expert testimony that will either strongly support one side or derail the other, then a settlement is what is called for and not trial. Far too often, it is found out at trial that one of those is the case, that perhaps one side has a much stronger case than was anticipated. And by that time, the expenses have been incurred and the time for settlement sometimes can be lost, although we certainly do settle in the middle of trial. But the Hospital Association supports notification before trial as to the experts that will be testifying to encourage settlement and avoid trial by ambush. And again, that serves everyone's purpose. This doesn't penalize a legitimate plaintiff. If they've got a strong witness to make it clear that they are deserving of payment of damages by any of the defendants, they can indicate that before trial, and that can be part of any settlement. It doesn't need to be done in trial by ambush. And, of course, by encouraging settlements before trial, we are serving to mitigate the escalating jury awards and the expenses associated with trial that are helping to drive malpractice rates up for both physicians and for hospitals. So this bill would also promote the goal of mitigating malpractice rates and thereby promoting greater access to necessary care for your constituents.
Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Crew?
To be clear, Mr. Chair, the Oregon Medical Association also supports House Bills 2492, 93, and 94. House Bill 2495 is a bill that proposes to limit contingency fees that attorneys can collect in medical malpractice cases. And to be clear, again, the OMA supports this bill. My law firm does not advocate the limitation of fees that attorneys can charge. But I want to. This bill was brought here because of the polling that was done by Moore and others on behalf of the OMA, which shows that the public supports this bill by an excess of 70%. The bill proposes to limit contingency fees in medical malpractice cases to 40% of the first $50,000 of recovery, 25% of the next $500,000 and 15% above that amount. The objective of the bill is to put more money into the pockets, if you will, of the injured party, and it is the primary purpose. It voids any contract that is contrary to the statute and only applies to actions filed after the effective date of the act. Any questions?
Any questions? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chairman. We've heard some objections to trial by ambush. I'm wondering about the support of 2495 in light of the fact that 70% of the public, according to a poll, supports it if this is trial by polls.
Could well be, Representative Jensen. I'm simply saying that this limitation has been enacted into law in California and is found to work well. It's a part of MICRA. It was a part of a poll that was done several months back by the Oregon, on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association, which showed broad support among the public.
Representative Pozanski?
Yes. Since you brought up the poll, I'm wondering if you could get us the data on the poll, as well as the questions that were actually posed to the individuals. I'd like to see what type of questions or what references were made to get that determination, since you're asking this committee to consider that.
I will inquire of the OMA if they will make that available to the committee.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you. Are you done?
No.
I didn't think so.
2496. Okay. 2496 is a so-called collateral source bill. It proposes to make under current law, 18 ORS 18580, a court has the discretion to deduct from any judgment or jury award the amount of any collateral benefit which the plaintiff has received, with certain numbered exceptions. I won't go into those. The purpose of this bill is to make the set off of so-called collateral sources mandatory. Again, the purpose behind the bill is to put money in the pocket of the plaintiff, but at the same time, because of the current crisis in health care, to attempt to reduce the amount of monies that insurers and doctors are required to pay out in the event of judgment. I might also add that after further consideration and discussions with the OMA, we believe, and we're not going to propose it today, but the bill should be amended to apply to all civil cases, not just medical malpractice cases. And if there's any questions on that, I'll take them. Otherwise, I'll move to the next bill. 2497. This is a comparative fault bill. This bill essentially does two things, or attempts to do two things. It amends or proposes to amend ORS 18470 to allow the trier of fact to consider the negligence of any tortfeasor, whether they're named or unnamed. That's number one. And I might add, to the extent that an unnamed tortfeasor's negligence is brought into the case, it's the burden of the defense, of course, to prove that to the satisfaction of the trier of fact. The other part of the bill, which is paragraph 4 of subsection 1, allows the defense to make a decision in a case. Under current law, if a party has settled, and if the defense wants to have the court or jury consider the negligence of the settling party, they must prove up the negligence of that settling party during trial. This would allow the defense to make a decision whether to try that negligence or to forego trial of trying the negligence, and to simply have the court deduct from the judgment the amount of the settlement. I think there are members of the defense bar that are here today that intend to speak in favor of the bill, and I would take any questions if the committee has any. House Bill 2498 is a bill that proposes to limit the amount of interest that can be charged on a medical malpractice judgment. I will again say that the Oregon Medical Association, after further consideration, believes that this bill should be amended. It should be amended in two regards. First, It should, as currently written, it only applies to medical malpractice. Practically speaking, it should apply to all judgments rendered in civil cases. That's number one. Number two is the struggle we have is if you take a static interest rate, currently 9%, it seems too high under current economic conditions when you can hope to get 2.5% on a certificate of deposit or a savings account at the local bank. For example, if you were to have a judgment rendered against you today in the circuit court of the state of Oregon, the interest rate would be 9%. And let's say it is a medical malpractice case. If you had the same judgment rendered against you in the U.S. Federal District Court for the state of Oregon, it would be 1.22%. It's called the federal rate. And that rate varies from day to day based upon one-year Treasury notes. And what we would propose is to take the federal rate, which we frankly think is too low, and possibly add 2 or 3 percentage points to it, and allow the rate of interest on a civil judgment to track the economy based upon what the federal government can borrow money for, as opposed to a static rate. And so we will be proposing that amendment to the bill. If there's no other questions, House Bill 2591, it's a bill that proposes to allow periodic payment of judgments in the event that the judgment is in excess of $100,000. I will tell you that on further reflection, we again intend to propose an amendment to this bill to take out any reference to property damage. It doesn't really make any sense. But having said that, if a judgment in a personal injury case is in excess of $100,000 under the proposed bill, in excess of $100,000 for future economic and non-economic damages, those damages could be paid upon motion over a period of time. Presumably the defense would make a motion for periodic payment and set forth the basis of the proposal, and the plaintiffs would be allowed to respond. The court could set down the terms of periodic payment, including security for the payment, and if during any period that the payment is called for, 3 or more payments are late in any 12-month period, the plaintiff could go to court and require that the entire balance of the judgment be paid in full, including their attorney's fees for asking for acceleration. And that, in essence, is the cap bill. I might add that this is well beyond my area of expertise. I understand that at least one insurance company is to come in and testify what they believe the effect of the cap will be. I guess the theory behind it is it gives them a better chance to predict cash flow. It does not attempt to limit the amount of damages in any way that a plaintiff can recover.
Okay, are there questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does this bill interface with the federal bill that is going through the Congress on malpractice?
Well, I have to profess I don't know all the details of the federal bill, but I understand there is some call on that bill for a periodic payment as well. For a cap?
I believe it's $50,000.
Ms. Dayton.
Chair Williams, Representative Anderson, I can tell you that while certainly the bill on the federal level is fluid, as all bills are, most of the provisions that are being discussed today are contained in the federal bill. This most significant difference between the federal bill and what you're hearing about today is, as you indicated, the federal bill does have a cap on non-economic damages.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I fully appreciate your argument on discussion on 2498 as far as the 9%. I think most of us in here would love to be able to get 9% now on any of the savings that we have. But when I moved down to 2591, $100,000, that in today's world, kind of strikes me as not the type of money that it would have when I was a boy, or even for that matter when I was a young parent. And I thought you were proposing, as far as the interest rate in 2498, some type of a adjustment factor there, and I was wondering, with the economy, if it is that wise to tie the $100,000 without having some sort of perhaps adjustment there as the economy fluctuates up and down, and especially as it goes up, I suppose.
Presuming that either of the parties requesting periodic payment necessarily would, I would assume, have some sort of actuarial analysis of what the future would look like for the economy, and presuming that would take into consideration both the ups and downs and the interest rates. The bill does call for interest to be added back because it is the time value of money, and to the extent it's not paid, the injured party ought to receive something for the non-payment. That said, again, I think it's someone much wiser than I would have to explain how those things are predicted and figured.
Thank you.
Other questions, Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll direct this to either of the witnesses, and you can decide who should jump in on it. Is it not the case that now it's a predominant pattern that there is a structured settlement or even after judgment of many personal injury awards that is designed to try to structure the flow of cash so that it meets the particular needs of the victim? Is that the prevailing practice now, or am I mistaken about that?
Well, certainly where structured settlements are used, that indeed is the current practice. And I think theoretically it's to maintain to propose enough money to maintain the needs of the injured party, with hopefully holding back sufficient amounts for later years where they can offer a much greater amount of money, in the sense of that the insurance company has been able to invest it and grow it, if you will, to pay it out at some distant point in the future.
Right. Follow up if I could, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What function does this bill, would it have enacted, play in that process then? Because it would appear to me that what it does is it restricts the flexibility of the parties then to work out something, a fit between the payment of a settlement or a judgment and the needs of the victim.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I don't think it would. If the parties are of a mind to, even if this bill were to pass, to enter into a structured settlement, nothing would stop them from doing that. This is only as to those cases that actually go to verdict. And then the defendant decides that they want to at least attempt to convince the court that they should be allowed to pay the judgment in periodic payments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Thank you both very much for the overview. Ms.
Well,
Newton, you look like you've got some answers.
I do, just very briefly, with the permission of the Chair. I did want to make it clear that despite the fact that Mr. Crewe and I divided up discussion of the bills to support efficiency of testimony, the Hospital Association does support House Bill 2495, 2591, and 2498, in addition to the bills that I actually testified on, for the reasons that are expressed in my testimony.
Thank you very much for putting that on the record. Okay, thank you both. What I intend to do, because we did open up hearings on all the bills, is to try to make sure that some of the people who we think we're only going to have a chance to maybe hear from today get an opportunity to testify, knowing that we're going to have these bills back up and open tomorrow, where other people will get to testify if we run out of time today. So with that proviso, I'm going to ask Dr. Glenn Rodriguez from Providence Health Systems to come forward. And also, if you don't mind being joined at the table, Doctor, I'm going to ask Jeff, I think it's Hetherington, did I get that right? Dr. Hetherington, maybe I'm missing.
He stepped out.
Did he step out?
I think so.
Okay. Okay, so if we'll go ahead and start with you, Doctor, and then we'll bring up Dr. Hetherington after you're done. Please proceed.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
For the record, my name is Glenn Rodriguez, and I'm really appearing here in two capacities. One is as Chief Medical Officer of Providence Health System in the Portland service area, and the second is as a practicing physician, a family physician and geriatrician in Southeast Portland, where I practice out of one of our community-oriented health centers. Providence has been caring for people in Oregon for over 150 years, and today we represent the largest healthcare system in the state and the second largest private employer. We operate hospitals in both urban and rural Oregon, including Portland, Milwaukee, Newburgh, Seaside, Hood River, and Medford for our facilities. We also sponsor long-term care facilities in Portland, Gresham, Mount Angel, Seaside, and we also sponsor about 120 member physician group practice in the state of Oregon. Providence supports the package of bills before you and believes they offer modest, reasonable proposals to begin reining in the rapid increase in medical liability costs. I'm really here to testify specifically in support of House Bill 2492, House Bill 2494, and House Bill 2497. And a couple specific comments on those bills, and then I'd also like to cast some general comments about the challenges before us all in the medical liability system. House Bill 2492, as was outlined, really provides for greater fairness in allocating damages to parties proportional to their liability as determined by the court. 2494 really does help by allowing pre-trial disclosure of expert witnesses. However, we would suggest that simplifying some of the disclosure requirements might help lower overall costs of that provision, but certainly should continue to include the identity, the medical specialty, the expert, the employer, the location of their practice, and a summary of the opinions to be used at trial. And finally, House Bill 2497 also provides relief around the allocation of fault, again, this was outlined, and we endorse, again, all three of these bills. Probably more personally important is the opportunity to speak what I see personally as the impact of the medical liability system on patients, clinicians, and particularly physicians. In my practice, I do now see the huge human toll of the eligibility cutbacks, benefit reductions that we've had to make in the state this year, and see very personally and directly what it means when, as people begin to have diminished access to healthcare services. I believe that fundamental tort reform is really needed to play a role in, an important role really, in limiting the rapid rise of healthcare costs, and most importantly really to preserve access to healthcare for all Oregonians around the state. Now I know that you've heard much testimony, you will hear much more testimony over the next couple of days, and there's plenty of points of disagreement. But I think there are, at least I would offer, and perhaps this is naive, but I would offer there's three points that we really all could agree on. First is that the medical liability system as it currently exists is very expensive, and costs are rising very rapidly. The GA report of that was in the latest HHS report of March 3rd, 2003, estimates that the aggregate premiums represent about 1% of all healthcare costs, and extrapolated to today's cost, that would represent somewhere around $14 billion. Of course, it's been alluded to by earlier speakers, the cost of hidden costs, the defensive medicine costs, add, and again, HHS estimated another 5 to 9% to healthcare costs. Now, those all sound very abstract, but when you start taking it down to a unit of service, begin to understand what these costs really mean. And it's a little hard to estimate because of different premiums, et cetera, but one specific situation I'm aware of and have spoken to the physicians involved in Grant Union County, one of the frontier counties in the state, there's only so many deliveries in the county and only so many limited numbers of physicians. Looking at the cost increases they've seen for 2003, they've had to cut back from 5 physicians providing maternity care services to just 2 physicians providing maternity care services. And even with that cutback, it's $600 per delivery medical liability costs alone. Those $600 only buy the malpractice premium. And again, in a part of the state that makes very real what those costs mean. Another area besides maternity care that's experienced very rapidly rising costs really is nursing home care. And a decade ago, the cost for liability coverage for a nursing home was about $20 per bed per month. In 2003, based on the HHS report and nationwide averages, that's now $200 per month for a nursing home bed for the liability premiums. And again, as we look in the state, as we've had to cut back on eligibility for seniors to support long-term care services, I think that cost of $200 per bed per month becomes very, very real. I'd also like to share our own experience within Providence Health System, what's happened to our liability costs. We self-insure a component of those costs and then buy layered insurance past that. But we've seen rapid escalation in our costs over the last 2 years. In 2001, the combination of internal self-assessments for the self-insurance and external premiums was $4.3 million. In 2002, that rose by 76% to $7.6 million. And in 2003, the allocation or that premium component rose to $10.9 million, so over more than doubling over that two-year period. In addition, on top of that $10.9 million, our internal actuaries have determined we now, as sort of as a mid-year adjustment in 2003, have another $6.5 million allocation on top of that. So, again, almost doubling the cost of the year before. You know, to put some perspective, as we've faced, again, cutbacks to try to maintain health care services to the state, we estimate that the cut in DRG payments to our health system in Oregon from the latest round of budget cuts are statewide around $12 million. So it begins to put some of these things in alignment and in perspective that the costs are very real, and I would argue really unsustainable for all of us. The second point that I would argue we could all agree on is that the current system is actually very inefficient. It does a very poor job of getting the benefits to people that actually need them or have been harmed. You've heard the figure earlier that 43% of settlement dollars go to injured parties or to citizens. If you look at premiums paid, that number drops further down to only 28% of premiums paid actually go to the citizens. So if you take that $14 billion investment in malpractice insurance premiums, less than $4 billion of that actually goes to injured parties, and over $10 billion goes to the administrative and legal costs in the system. On average, an injured party who achieves settlement or judgment on average waits 5 years for any actual payment from that. And as the system focuses attention on certain areas, as we've talked about, maternity care, nursing home care, the increasing liability costs impact all providers, not just those that have had quality problems or bad experience. And that is what then really drives the third problem we can all agree on, is that Oregonians really lose in the end when the high cost means that fewer citizens have access to health care, both through the indirect costs on insurance premiums, but also then the rising number of uninsured overall. We have experience in a variety of areas, and just an example at Providence Medford Medical Center, four of the family physicians on staff there have dropped OB privileges in the last year because of the malpractice costs. So you've already heard from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, the Oregon Medical Association. We share those concerns. There are many pressures on our physician community that already contribute to or soon will lead to access problems for Oregonians, access to health care problems. The cost of medical liability is one pressure point where really some relief is possible, and I think should be vigorously pursued. And that's why these bills before you, though not comprehensive reform, represent an important first step. I guess in closing, I'd like to point out that beyond these first steps, there really remains the challenge of fixing the existing system. And I think we really need to rethink how we can facilitate a safer healthcare delivery system. I personally bear responsibility for that within the Providence Health System, working towards that long-term goal. And I find the recent Institute of Medicine report on medical errors called To Err Is Human. I'll offer you this quote, which I think captures well the spirit of the challenge before us. And this quote says, "The focus must shift from blaming individuals for past errors to a focus on preventing future errors by designing safety into our healthcare systems. But the litigation system impedes this progress, not only because of the fear of litigation deters reporting, but also because the scope of litigation system's view is restricted. The litigation system looks at the past, not the future, and focuses on individual in effort to assess blame rather than considering how improvements can be made in the system. Tort law's overly emotional and individualized approach has been a tragic failure. All participants in the debate around medical liability have an opportunity to be a part of a new solution, one that preserves evidence-based medicine, enhanced patient safety, really strives to create trust through transparency, and removes flaws. The end result will be a safer and more open environment where physicians, as the physician who spoke today mentioned, can work on building the relationship with their patients that facilitates true healing. Thank you for addressing these issues, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Dr. Rodriguez, I was interested in your comment in which you cited with approval that we have to have transparency in this process, and this process is certainly complicated and justifies that. I was curious, therefore, in that vein, what the gross revenue for your operations are from 2001 and 2002. You cite the increase in malpractice costs, and I was wondering if you could give us some idea of the scope of your activities, and particularly whether any increased medical activities, increased gross, might be a partial reason for the increase in medical malpractice insurance.
Well, it's certainly true that malpractice costs are proportional to the amount of work you do, and I don't know the exact numbers about growth of service. It's not been anywhere near that doubling kind of percentage, and I don't know those exact numbers, but it's been on the order of a 5 to 8% growth in service delivered. I don't know those exact numbers.
Okay. Could you provide those?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Sure.
And second, I have two more questions, Mr.
Yes,
Sheriff.
Yes, you may.
Just so I can become a little more familiar with your industry, do you know if your insurance, I assume you insure through an insurance company, are they pooling your risk with other similarly situated operations, or are you being rated separately for insurance purposes, or do you know?
Again, Representative Ackley, I can't answer the details of your questions. We could get you additional information. The outline I can give you is, again, that we self-insure up to an initial dollar limit, and then we buy external insurance in layers, but I would have to get details to be able to provide them to you.
That was going to be my third question, Mr. Chairman, was your ability to self-insure, and what extent of that is a part of your business? You self-insure up to certain limits of liability or certain amounts, or could you tell us that?
Again, I would be happy to get you additional information that make sure that I have it right, because I'm not sure I can give you the exact figures. My understanding is that we self-insure up to a $5 million limit, but I'd prefer to verify and get you those accurate figures.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Sherrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much a question, maybe an expression of a comment, expression of frustration, because I agree with the testimony we've heard so far today, that, and what we heard for the most part of last week, that the costs associated with liability insurance really do put at risk the state's ability to provide sometimes basic care in rural communities, and it also, I think, restricts our ability to provide specialized care. Because of the concerns we had from some of the specialists last week who were concerned about moving forward into more technical and risky procedures and tend not to do that, and so we're restricting then access not only in communities but also within specialties. But in the what I'm so far, I go back to the testimony we heard last week from probably the one person who was best able to quantify the impact of these bills on premiums, and that was the actuary, I think, from CNA, who said it probably won't have any effect on premiums. And I think you referred to it as being not comprehensive reform, and I agree. These bills are, you know, a piece here and a piece there, but it's not comprehensive reform. And we can pass all these things, and from what I heard last week from the actuary and what my gut tells me, our obstetricians down on the South Coast and our pediatric neurological surgeons are still going to be faced with the same kind of cost issues for at least the foreseeable future. And I just wish somehow we could get coordinated between what we've got before us and what the real goal ought to be, or is, I think, for that we all have, and that is to address the costs that are putting at risk our ability to provide medical care in rural communities and also to maintain care in specialty areas that we desperately need. Again, not a question, but just a comment. I hear your testimony, and what would frustrate me greatly is that we strain mightily at six or seven bills, we pronounce the patient healed, and then the next year and 2 years and 3 years later, we see no change in the situation out in the communities and the specialties, and we all say, what on earth did we do?
Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Hetherington.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My apologies for not being here the first time I was called, but I'm glad to have the degree that I was just granted. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the executive director for the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon, and I'm known as an MR, not a DR. It's a Mr. I'd like to say on behalf of the members of the Osteopathic Association that we are very much in favor of all of these bills. I won't go through the detail because I think that's been done ably by the other proponents. I would say a couple of things. Our members are mostly in primary care, but a lot of them out in the rural areas. The comments that Representative Shetterly made about the impact in the rural areas, I think, is very real. You see malpractice rates that have gone up 200-300% for these people. They're dropping a number of procedures that a lot of rural docs do because there aren't specialists out there, and they are no longer insured for doing them in many cases. And primary among that, of course, is obstetrics. We think that this is a serious problem. I would agree that it's certainly not the comprehensive fix that we would like, but I would say to the committee, you got to start somewhere. And we would certainly urge your favorable consideration on these bills.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Hetherington? Yes, Representative.
Yes. Could you tell us who the major medical carrier is for your clients or members?
Well, with the osteopathic physicians, generally either the same with the MDs. It's either CNA or Northwest Physicians Mutual are the primary carriers.
Fine. Thank you.
Anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shelley.
Just one more, and appreciate your comments. It does seem to me that we have in the rural communities in particular a crisis, and I don't think it's an overstatement to call it that. And again, back at these in terms of a place to start, it's almost like taking if I can venture into a medical analogy, which I know is dangerous, but it'd be like taking a patient who's in cardiac arrest and talking to them about changing their diet. I mean, that seems to me to be the place we are here. We're not dealing with the immediate need, the life and death issues, really, in the local communities where these practices are at risk and the specialties are at risk. But instead, we're kind of talking about taking some first steps towards some long-term changes. And frankly, we may be missing an opportunity, and I don't have the roadmap to get us there, but I'd sure rather be talking about some things that are going to have some quicker impact on the real need, and that is cost of providing medical care in our rural communities and in specialties that we have to support the broader array of medical services.
Anything else, Representative Jensen?
Are we doing comments now, or...
Well, I was hoping to stay focused on
Never
questions,
mind.
but if you feel the urge or need to respond to the representative from Dallas, I'll give you the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly, as a representative from
the east side of the mountains and one who has, you know, spent most of his adult and professional life in those uncharted wilderness out there, I really appreciate everybody's concern and interest in rural communities and especially in rural Oregon. However, you know, having some experience in rural Oregon, I'd like to point out that there are many other factors than medical malpractice insurance or whatever it might be that affect whether people want to and are willing to come and stay and live in rural Oregon. We have lost in my city, and that's a something of an exaggeration of the term city, but we have lost two physicians because their spouses didn't have a social life of the type that they wanted to become accustomed to, and so they moved to the concrete pastures and asphalt of Portland to find that social life. My spouse in an allied field found it very difficult over the past 30 years, now it's not dealing with the current type of situation, to hire a professional people in the mental health field because they too wanted to trade for the concrete and asphalt and cultural and excitement, maybe that they could go to Blazer games or something that they found far more entertaining than the local high school football, basketball games. And my experience at the college was somewhat the same thing. We had a terrible time, difficult time. We paid good money and good opportunities, but we simply could not hire with the same ease that our counterparts over here with the concrete and asphalt could. So while I want you to watch out for rural Oregon, I'd be somewhat cautious of where we're going on these.
Okay. Thank you, committee. Let's try to keep focused. Oh. All of us stay focused.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krummel, I care to ask.
Could I actually ask a couple of questions related to to what we're hearing?
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, how many members are there to the Osteopathic Association?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, we have around 420 POs.
Okay. And did you, the other question is, did you happen to look as an association or just you yourself at the idea of a professional liability fund and what kind of amounts a DO might have to pay to be a part of that as opposed to paying for liability insurance?
Well, I guess the quick answer would be no, we haven't looked at it. The members are frankly opposed to that.
Okay.
And at least the information that we have looked at and knowing what you have to set up for an insurance fund, it'd be astronomical just to get the thing started.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else for Mr. Hetherington? All right. Seeing none, thanks. Next up, Jonathan Hoffman and Martha Hodgkinson.
Good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Hoffman. I'm a partner at the law firm of Martin Bischoff in Portland, Oregon. I believe I'm in Representative McPherson's district, and I don't think we have any fancy clubs there either. But this is Martha Hodgkinson from Hoffman, Hart, and Wagner, not the different Hoffman. I wanted to speak first about... Oh, and by the way, before I get into it, Representative Krummel, you asked a question earlier about, in the case of a baby that was born, how long would the doctor have exposure after that? And I think Mr. Crew was unsure about it. I believe the answer is this, that there is a date of discovery rule, that is, that after it happens, the statute doesn't start to run until the plaintiff, you know, knows or should reasonably know that there is some kind of claim. there's an outside limit under the Oregon statute of repose of 10 years. So I believe the rule would be that there would be potential exposure for the doctor for 10 years after the baby was born. That's my off-the-cuff answer to that. Anyway, I wanted to address House Bill 2493 and 2494. My practice is principally involved in defending both aviation and product liability cases. I'm licensed to practice in both Oregon and Alaska. My first 6 years were working for the U.S. Department of Justice, defending Federal Tort Claims Act cases. Those were mostly in federal court. Of course, since then, I've been in both state and federal court. I want to try to give a concrete example. Oh, and by the way, I've got... I've got some written remarks here. I'm not going to say all this. this is my comments on 2493, and then I have a little more on 2494. I wanted to try to give a concrete example or some examples of how these issues come up and why I believe that they are important. I believe that both of these bills are important and they should be passed. Take an example. Suppose that you have the best qualified expert in the world who gets up to testify. Let's suppose that you have Aristotle getting up to testify, and Aristotle proposes to testify to the jury that if you take a ball this big and a ball this big and you drop them from the Tower of Pisa, that the small ball will fall slower than the big ball will. Okay? And he's qualified as an expert. He's supremely qualified as an expert. But he's done nothing to verify whether that opinion is true or not. He's done nothing that we consider to be the reliable hallmarks of science, which, and I use that example because the classic example of what we now call modern science is that people believe that for 1,500 years or 2,000 years until Galileo, the apocryphal story is, went up to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped two objects of different weights and discovered that they fell at the same rate. And that's what science is all about, is taking a hypothesis and not simply saying, because I'm smart and because I have a degree and because I'm well known, that I can say these things, but to test the hypothesis in a way that people can determine for their own eyes whether it's true or false. And that is what the Daubert test that the federal courts established in 1993, that's what that's all about. It starts with the proposition that an expert should not be able to come into court and say things to a jury that have not been derived by the same degree of intellectual rigor as experts in that field would use outside of the courtroom. That is, that if experts today determine the answer to that question by doing a certain kind of test, that you should expect that experts who come in to testify should do the same kind of testing and analysis that experts outside the courtroom do. Now, I submit that's a matter of common sense. The problem that comes up is that our legal culture in this state, and in many states prior to the Daubert case, was that if you had a case, and maybe you didn't have a very good case, but you're trying to do the best for your client, there were certain people in town that you could call up, and they'd have a credential, and you'd pay them some money, and they'd say, what do you need? And they would give you the opinion that you want so that you can get your case to a jury, and if you're the plaintiff, get some money, if you're the defendant, so you can defeat the plaintiff. And I don't think this is a plaintiff and defendant issue, because I think historically both plaintiffs and defendants were guilty of using these kinds of experts, hired guns, as it were, to try to sell their case to the jury that otherwise did not have merit. And the question I submit to you is whether that is the kind of expert testimony that you think should be encouraged and allowed in the courts of this state. Because I'm here to tell you that that is the kind of expert testimony that is still being used in the courts of this state, even though the federal courts over the last decade have dramatically changed the standards under which they allow expert testimony. And the federal courts, with the trilogy of cases, namely the Daubert case, the Joyner case, and finally the Kumho Tire case, have basically said that the expert will be expected to show the same degree of intellectual rigor in deriving his or her opinions before testifying in court that we would expect of somebody in that field outside of court. And the judge has a duty as the gatekeeper to make sure that experts do not testify to opinions in front of the jury that do not meet a certain level of reliability in terms of how they were derived, that they're validly derived from reliable evidence, and using the proper techniques that ensure reliability that are used by experts in the particular field. In my written remarks, and I won't go through all of them, I gave you some specific examples from my own personal experience where I have seen experts who have come in and testified to things that if you told somebody in a particular field that people are coming into a courtroom and testifying that way, they would be aghast. I gave one example of an engineer who came in and testified. It was a case involving a helicopter crash. And the pillow block bolts that hold the rotor system to the mast, all four of them failed at some point during the crash. The helicopter crashed into a swamp, and none of the bolts were ever recovered. And this expert came in, and holding the invisible bolt up to the jury, he said, as a metallurgist, I can tell you this bolt failed as a result of fatigue, corrosion fatigue, and when I asked him, where did it fail? He said, it failed right here. And he pointed to the imaginary place on the bolt where it failed. Never did a test. Nobody ever did a test of the bolt. There weren't any tests. There were no bolts. The way that metallurgists determine what causes the failure of such a bolt are well established. Everybody, any metallurgist worth his salt, plaintiff or defense metallurgist, knows exactly what to do and what you can determine in terms of the cause of the failure of a bolt. He didn't do it. He just made it up. And, you know, I cross-examined him the best I could, but frankly, he had more trial experience than I did, and a lot of these experts do. They testify hundreds of times. I've had clients who try to get me to use an expert who's testified in 300 trials or 500 trials. I don't like to use people like that. I like to use somebody who brings legitimate expertise in their field to the jury, not somebody who's a professional gun for hire. And that's what 2493 is all about. 2494 is an important element of that because with our current trial by ambush system, there is no way for the court to exercise any kind of gatekeeping role over what expert testimony gets to the jury if you don't know who the expert is or what they propose to say until the person gets up on the stand, which is the way we do things now. So I've defended cases involving multi-million-dollar claims, you know, claims with quadriplegics, people with permanent brain injuries who are in a vegetative state, millions, tens of millions of dollars potentially at stake, and my client says, well, you know, maybe we should settle a case. What is their case? I say, I don't know. Well, who are they going to use as their experts? I don't know. Okay. I know when the person takes the stand at trial. Now, I know that in other states, when we exchange reports or depositions of experts, if the expert says, and I gave some examples of this in my comments to 2494, we had a case up in Alaska where there was a side impact between two vehicles, very high-speed side impact, terrible brain injuries to the two high school girls who were seated on the side of the car that was broadsided. And the claim was that the door should have been stronger. If only you'd built a stronger door, you could have prevented those injuries. And because of the benefits of the discovery that we have in 49 other states and in federal court, we were able, once we knew what they were saying should have been done with the door, we went out and we built a door like the plaintiff's expert said the door should have been built. And we ran a test where we duplicated the forces. We duplicated the crash. The same bullet vehicle, the same other vehicle, except that we beefed up the door just the way they said it should have been done. And what we found is it makes no difference, given the nature of the crash that occurred. Now, that's what you can do to verify or to refute another expert's testimony if you have the opportunity to know what they're going to say. But if an expert gets up on Tuesday and says, here's what you should have done, and then they rest, and you're supposed to put your case on Wednesday, there's absolutely no way you can do it. So what you end up with is a swearing contest between experts when there's really no way to determine the validity of this through cross-examination because you don't know really where the plaintiff is coming from. And it goes the other way around, too. I have inflicted at least as much surprise upon plaintiffs as I have received as a defendant. And I would say that both of these measures, although I would suspect that the plaintiff's bar generally would oppose them and most defense lawyers would probably support them, I would say that, in my view, they are neutral because they allow the party that has the good case to prove that and to disprove the false elements of the opponent's case, whether that is a plaintiff or a defendant. And I can also tell you, and this will be the last comment I'll make other than questions you might have, I have on occasion done plaintiff's work, although I'm mostly a defense lawyer. I had a case in which I represented a plaintiff. In fact, my plaintiff was a plaintiff's lawyer, and we sued an insurance company for improperly denying him his disability benefits over a stress claim. And they'd been paying for 7 years. All of a sudden, they said, we're not paying anymore. And we sued the insurance company. And the insurance company tried to call three doctors. It was two psychiatrists and a psychologist to testify that this guy wasn't disabled. None of them ever examined him. They were going to give an opinion about what was, you know, nothing was wrong with this guy without ever having conducted an examination. And so I filed a motion. This is in federal court, thank goodness. I filed a motion to say you shouldn't allow these experts to testify because they haven't done what doctors are supposed to do, which is you're supposed to examine somebody before you give an opinion as to what their condition is. Now, I ended up winning the motion on a different ground. I didn't win on that basis, but it didn't hurt to have the Daubert-Kumho rule. And that's what 2493 would do, and I think that's the way the law ought to be in this state, just like it is in our federal courts. That's all I have, unless anybody has any questions.
Why don't we see if Ms. Hodgkinson, do you want to speak to the bills, and then we'll open up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Martha Hodgkinson. I'm a lawyer at Hoffman, Hart & Wagner. We're primarily a firm that does a lot of defense work. I've been practicing for almost 17 years, and I have a variety of cases in my practice, all defense work. I'm here today on behalf of my partner, John Hart, and other members of my firm, as well as the Oregon Medical Association, to support House Bill 2492, 2493, and 2494. And I won't spend too much time on what Mr. Hoffman just discussed, except to say that I think everybody in this room, whether you're a plaintiff's lawyer or a defense attorney, has the same interest in preserving the integrity of our system. The trial by jury system is under attack from many different sources, but I think everyone agrees that it needs to be protected. I think these bills, the three bills that I'm here to support, as well as some others today, preserve the integrity of the system by providing fundamental fairness to both sides. I think that the lawyers in this room who are going to speak again for both sides are all experienced, good attorneys, and that you can't change the facts of your case. If your case is a good case and the system supports taking a good case to trial, then the outcome will be right. I think all of us who practice have this respect for the system and want it to succeed. The disclosure of experts rule as proposed would be consistent with federal court, has already been pointed out today. And it would give each side an idea of what the other side is going to face at trial. It's hard to explain, unless you've been through a trial, how much of a cost it exacts, not only on your client, but on the system. There's costs expended on both sides. If you indeed have a good case, and it must be proved by expert testimony, my practice is not necessarily medical. I represent architects, engineers, contractors, other professionals. The same requirements are here. You need to have expert testimony in order to make your case, in order for the jury to understand whether or not there's been negligence. And if there is preliminary disclosure of experts, it allows each side to take a look at the person, evaluate where their case is, and determine whether or not they need to pursue settlement. In recent years, I think it's been recognized that settlement is very desirable in many cases where there could be a huge risk to the defendant or the plaintiff. And the problem with settlement and why we don't have more settlement, especially in medical malpractice cases, is because we can't evaluate our cases. And that's true for plaintiff and defendant alike. If you have disclosure of experts, if you know what the expert's general area of expertise and his qualifications are, or her qualifications, you can then advise your clients in a better way, a more meaningful way. And I won't say much more on those two bills other than to say that I think if they were passed, they will benefit both sides. Both plaintiff and defendant will be able to hone their case to exactly what it is. Frivolous cases will be hopefully prevented from going to trial. Cases that should be settled will hopefully be recognized early on and earmarked for settlement. I want to speak briefly about 2492. It's been discussed at length today by Ms. Dawson and others, and again, this goes to the integrity of the system and fundamental fairness. If I'm flipping back and forth here, but this is the several liability proposal, and if Oregon passes this bill or something that is similar to it, we will have true several liability, meaning that the defendant who has been found to be responsible for a portion of the plaintiff's injuries will pay that. And no other, and that defendant will not be responsible for some other defendant's share of the liability. The reason this is important is that in order to avoid a potential windfall at the extreme detriment of a defendant, a plaintiff needs to understand going into a case that if the judgment is potentially uncollectible against a party, but collectible against another party, that factors again into settlement discussions. It provides a frank, open discussion of how this will work, of who will be responsible and in what percentage, and it really, again, works towards fairness in a verdict for apportioning liability. And 2497 works as a dovetail to 2492, and again, would promote fundamental fairness, and the system would work better if the results of a trial are not skewed, don't provide a windfall for plaintiffs, but provide an actual proportionate share of fault that a jury finds after hearing all the facts. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for either Ms. Hoffman Mr. Hoffman or Ms. Hutch? We'll start with actually Representative Barker, then Representative Prozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say 49 other states do have this law already in place?
I the last time I looked, I believe that there is now disclosure in there. For a while, New York was the last holdout besides Oregon, but I believe now New York has some kind of expert disclosure. But I think we are the last state that has trial by ambush.
And do you, as I'm reading this bill, if I'm not mistaken, for example, something I'm a little more familiar with, in a case where somebody's suing a police department and bringing police experts, those would have to be disclosed ahead of time.
Sure, any expert.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Prozanski.
Thank you. Mr. Hoffman, or Dr. Hoffman, excuse me.
Mr.
Oh, Mr.
Yeah.
I had a question regarding the 2494 in conjunction with 2493. It seems to me that if you have 2494, you're going to take care of maybe the need to open up the door on 2493. You, as an attorney, I would assume, would have the ability to review the reports, know what they're actually going to be testifying to if there's discovery, with the reports from the expert coming in. You would then be able to, as you probably have done in your practice, be able to impeach these individuals when they come up with the ludicrous type of analogy of, here's the mystery boat. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair statement?
Well, to some degree. It depends on what the nature of the expert's opinion is. Certainly, in the vast majority of cases, by exchanging the expert reports, you may identify, you know, flaws in what the expert did that give each side a basis to meaningfully cross-examine the other side's expert. So that expert disclosure does assist the cross-examination of the other side's expert at trial. That's true. Is that sufficient? I would say no. The reason is what the other thing that 2493 does, which is not taken care of by 2494, has to do with the standard by which the trial court decides whether expert testimony is admissible at all. In other words, what is the threshold that the trial judge should use in deciding whether I'm going to allow that expert to testify? What has happened in the federal courts, bear in mind, the federal courts going back to, 1938, I think back to the beginning of the federal rules, had disclosure of expert testimony. But the fact that it was disclosed, the trial judges routinely let everything in, regardless of what it was, as long as the expert was qualified. What was changed in the Daubert decision was to establish a substantive threshold of reliability that the expert's testimony must meet before it will be deemed to be helpful and therefore admissible to the jury. So if the expert comes in and says, I derived my opinion by flipping coins or turning my eight ball on my desk upside down to see what it said, that one of the other things that that the report gives you is an opportunity to file a motion with the judge, a motion in limine, to exclude that opinion from being offered to the jury. So it allows you to meaningfully cross-examine where legitimate experts using legitimate methodology still will have disagreements about things. But what it also allows you to more meaningfully challenge things that are sort of outside the bell curve of what reasonable experts using reasonable methodology would arrive at. So it does both things. And you can't establish that second thing unless you have prior disclosure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Follow up. So in your testimony, you refer to these, in this situation, the judges would become gatekeepers.
Yes.
Kind of like an HMO as to what type of service that you may be able to provide. You're going to have someone that's going to check, and I assume the standard's going to be a matter of law.
Well, I hope it's not like the HMOs.
I hope so, too.
But the judge always has to determine what evidence is sufficiently relevant, material, whether an expert is qualified, whether evidence is hearsay. I mean, the judge's traditional role is to determine what evidence comes in and what evidence doesn't. So the standard that the judge uses, that this bill has taken, I believe, verbatim out of the new federal rule 702, is that the evidence must be derived in a basically using a reliable methodology. That is, the question the judge asks is not really, do I agree or disagree with the expert? The question is, what do experts in this field do? How do experts in this field arrive at reliable conclusions? And in most fields, there is something that gives you a roadmap as to how experts go about doing what they're doing. To take an example.
Ms. Kaufman, let me just ask you, instead of going for the example.
Sure.
If we had 2494 on the books, and if you worked as the attorney defending a case, found that the experts, based on the discovery to you, the disclosure was not relevant, or you didn't believe it was relevant, or that their testing mechanisms or means were not reliable, or not found in science,
mm-hmm.
are you saying that the judges would have to have 2493 to be able to make that determination before they would exclude that evidence?
What I'm saying is this, and I guess I didn't really hit this point clearly enough. What's happened in our state court, our current Rule 702 is identical to what was federal Rule 702 up until very recently. The problem was that the Oregon state courts have adopted what I would say is a far more lenient standard as to what passes muster under Rule 702. So that a state court trial judge in this state, even if you know what the opinion is, and even if you raise the objection and you say it's not relevant, it's not reliable, the state court judge is at much, much less risk if he just lets it in than if he keeps it out. And in fact, the Jennings case, which I discussed in the written comments, is an example where exactly the same issue was presented in both that there was a state and a federal court case. These both arose out of the breast implant litigation. And in federal court, there was a hearing involving all of the breast implant manufacturers and all the plaintiff's lawyers who had breast implant cases in the state of Oregon. There was a lengthy hearing about the reliability of the science that was being used to support the basic proposition the plaintiffs were relying on, which was, does silicone cause systemic disease in women? And Judge Jones, who taught evidence at Lewis and Clark Law School and was on the Oregon Supreme Court, had his own expert panel to advise him on the science and ultimately ruled that none of it was admissible because it was not reliable evidence derived through proper scientific means. 4 years later, same issue comes up in the state Supreme Court, and the Oregon Supreme Court held that it was error to exclude one small portion of that testimony, the exact issue, which was how, to what extent can you use differential diagnosis to establish a link between silicone, and systemic disease. In the federal court, Judge Jones said, unless you have some other way of showing that silicone is one of the things that causes systemic disease, you can't use differential diagnosis to create it as a means of elimination. The state Supreme Court said, oh, you must allow that in. It was error for the judge to keep that out. The effect of that is it means that the state court, even if you know what they're going to say, the judges are going to, and generally do, let just about everything in. So this is basically to incorporate the federal admissibility standard.
So, Mr. Hoffman, wouldn't it be fair to say that in those situations, either way, it's really going to come down to what a judge may decide as to what's relevant or not relevant, and then you're always going to have the potential of an appeal or based on the ruling of that judge?
Well, there's always the potential of that, even now. But it's not just a question of relevancy. It's a question of reliability. You know, and that's the language of this proposed amendment to 702 talks about, you know, a reliable methodology.
But instead of the jury making that determination as the Oregon Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution to allow the jury to make those determinations, what you're asking this body to do is to shift that to the determination of the judge.
Well, I don't think anybody has ever said that the Constitution requires the jury to decide what's reliable science. You know, certainly the jury is the ultimate finder of fact,
right,
in factual disputes. But that's different from deciding, you know, whether something is hearsay or not. Should we let the jury decide what's hearsay, or whether something fits within a hearsay exception, or whether something's relevant, or, you know, all the different rules of admissibility under the rules of evidence. The judge has a threshold determination whether something satisfies the evidentiary threshold. That's always been an issue of law for the court. So that it really doesn't get to the right to trial by jury, I would submit.
On the fact that wouldn't it, if that was a fact issue?
Well, if you have, if you have a situation where both sides have offered expert testimony that there's no question but that it's reliable, or that the judge says, I think this is a reliable methodology. This is one of the ways that experts in that field reliably determine answers to this kind of question. If the judge decides that, then it is for the jury to decide which expert they agree with or which one they disagree with.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
May I ask one question, Mr. Chair?
One quick, don't leave yet, Mr. Hoffman. One quick question, Representative. We've got some other witnesses we're going to try to get through before we have to close for the day.
Okay, thank you. Just real quickly, how often have you, and I was waiting for an attorney so I could ask you this question, but how often have you seen in jury makeup that, particularly in medical malpractice cases, that the jury is made up of doctors or nurses or people that or other ancillary health care providers, people that have a background in health care?
I don't do medical malpractice defense. I do product liability and aviation. I did have a Boeing engineer on an aviation case. That was one time in 25 years.
I could try and answer that question for you, Representative.
That'd be fine.
Our firm does quite a bit of medical malpractice defense. I've done some, but I've shifted away from that over the years. But since the lawyers have some control over who's going to be on the jury through their challenges and other means, typically you don't see a lot of health care practitioners, not a lot of doctors, sit on juries. In my experience and that of my partners, you have a fair amount of nurses or physical therapists, technicians, folks with that kind of background and training. But typically, you don't find a jury in a medical malpractice case loaded with people who are in that field.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask Larry Warbrock, Dave Miller, and Linda Eierman to come forward. Whoever would like to begin.
I'll go first because I think I'll be the briefest. My name is Larry Wolbrock. I've been a lawyer for 25 years. I'm a former president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I've represented mostly victims of medical malpractice for the last 25 years. I practice in Portland, and as a plaintiff's lawyer, I've often been on the other side of lawsuits in which the person to my left, Dave Miller, who will speak next, who used to be a defense lawyer defended. I'm speaking specifically to House Bill 2494, Expert Discovery, and I'm only going to talk, have a handout, and I'm going to talk about the first couple paragraphs there. Let me tell you that the conspiracy of silence regarding one doctor testifying against another is a very real and troublesome issue. If you pass 2494, you're going to make that situation, which is now difficult, even more difficult. What is going to happen as a consequence of the requirement that experts be disclosed is that plaintiffs are going to be driven into the hands or the province of professional expert witnesses. One of the reasons, and in the handout that I provided you, you will see ORCP 45, which is the summary judgment rule, which says motions under this rule are not designed to be used as discovery devices to obtain the names of potential expert witnesses or to obtain the facts, their facts or opinions. Instead, an attorney files an affidavit in good faith that says, I have an expert. The reason that was passed when the summary judgment rule was modified in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, as in the past, defendants would use a motion for summary judgment to, in the words of the vernacular, smoke out the identity of the plaintiff's experts. And I, for one, have had the uncomfortable experience of having an expert call me up and say, I have been threatened by my colleagues that if I testify in this case, I will not receive any referrals anymore. If that seems far-fetched, I bring your attention to the March 10th, 2003 New York Times article, which is in the handout that I gave you. And this relates to the walkout of doctors in New Jersey. And you will see the New York Times reports that the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights reported having gotten hold of the email of the New Jersey Medical Association that, and I'm quoting here, in the weeks leading up to the protest, physicians were advised that wavering colleagues should be threatened with loss of referrals, the financial mainstay of many private practices. You either are with us or, quote, you are either with us or against us. There is no in-between, the vice president of the Hudson Medical Society, Dr. Shikari, warned. Furthermore, they were told to cause confusion and inconvenience to their patients and to cease writing prescriptions for inexpensive generic medications and write prescriptions only for limited quantities, so patients are forced to make multiple visits. Don't call in prescriptions. Make the patients pick up the written script. That's the last paragraph on that page. Also in your packet, you will see a letter from a Michael Kelber, a doctor who had agreed to consult with a plaintiff's lawyer by the name of Greg Smith, and he says, based upon the recent malpractice crisis, he's no longer going to do this. The point of those documents before you is that doctors don't like medical malpractice cases. I'm sure you know that, and they don't like it when one of their colleagues testifies against them, and they will often do things to prevent that. And one of the things that they will do is exercise pressure on the referral basis to make sure that doesn't happen. I personally have had that experience. If you require the disclosure, which current Rule 45 is designed to prevent because of that specific problem, we are going to be driven into the hands of professional expert mills. You are not going to find local doctors who are willing to even look at a case. And that's not the system that you want. You want people from the community, people from reputable medical schools that will come forward and testify as to standard of care and causation and damages. The Council on Court Procedure has, in my experience, because I was involved in that, twice defeated this proposal. I recall Justice Graber, now of the Ninth Circuit, but then of the Supreme Court, and I don't suppose to talk for her, but I do recall her saying that any good lawyer will know what the experts are going to say on either side, and they'll learn that from their own experts. They know what the defenses are. They know what the other side is going to say. And as the lawyers on this committee know, code pleading in this state requires, particularly in medical malpractice and product liability actions, that if you're going to allege that the thickness of the door panel is the reason for the injury, you have to be very specific, and you have to say very specifically it wasn't 0.05 of an inch thicker as it should have been. That has to be pled. They know what the theories are. And to say that somehow this is trial by ambush is incorrect. The last thing I want to point out to, and Mr. Miller will point, talk to this in greater elaboration, is that the access to justice is an issue here. I've tried cases in Washington, in federal court, and in Oregon State Court. And it is 2 to 3 times more expensive to go through the expert discovery rigmarole that when we're all done, we really don't know much more about the case than when we started. My belief is, and my information, having talked to a New York lawyer less than a month ago, that New York is with us on this issue. There is no expert discovery in New York. The identity of experts is as it is in Oregon. Often the trial judges in our state, by the way, require the first day of trial that both sides name their experts. So it's not as if everybody's sitting around waiting for somebody to walk up to the front of the courtroom and raise their hand. Any lawyer that takes a case on a contingent fee is not going to go to all the trouble to get that case ready and get into the courtroom and not have experts lined up ready to testify. A percentage of zero, because the judge kicks it out because he hasn't heard the appropriate expert testimony, is still zero. Finally, and Mr. Miller will speak to this, this type of procedure involves the courts in many, many ancillary proceedings, and if you're concerned about judicial resources and the use of judicial time, Mr. Miller will speak to that, I believe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Miller. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, where I've practiced since 1982. My practice is such that I spent the first 18 years of my practice in this concrete jungle up there as a defense lawyer, defending physicians throughout Oregon, also trying cases in the states of Idaho and Florida on occasion on behalf of physicians who were sued for malpractice. 3 years ago, I changed my practice, and I do now a substantial number of cases on the plaintiff side of medical negligence, and I also continue to defend members of the healthcare industry and represent physicians before the licensing board, the Board of Medical Examiners, and in other forums. So I think I can represent to you all, I've seen both sides. And I want to address my comments specifically to House Bill 2494, which, of course, is the bill that would purport to require disclosure of expert witnesses. But I want to put it in context a bit and quickly, if I might. Currently, when a lawsuit is filed, and I will use medical malpractice cases as the example, the case, if filed in Portland, may or may not get to trial in Portland. In today's setting of the cuts that have affected our court system, for anywhere from 14 to 18 months. That's today. 2 years ago, I would have told you it was 12 months. And I think every lawyer on both sides of the bar would have agreed with me 2 years ago. Throughout the course of that period of time that a case is pending, there's depositions of the parties, there's exchange of documents, medical records, and then ultimately trial. Our case, if you talk to our system, if you talk to lawyers in other states and you explain what our system is the envy of lawyers in other jurisdictions. That's because we do not have the type of expert disclosures that are being advocated with this bill. From my point of view, having seen both sides of it, adding the types of disclosures that are required here would increase the cost of litigation to both sides. Bear in mind that when a plaintiff hires an expert witness, that physician is charging anywhere from $150 to $500 per hour for that expert testimony. Once the expert's engaged, if one needs to go to that expert and solicit a report from the expert, that's going to take additional time. The defense, if I were to put on my other hat as a defense lawyer, has to be able to respond to those reports by going to their own experts and showing the plaintiff's responses or expert reports to the defense experts, who are again charging the hourly rates they charge. Those are then exchanged, and then there's an opportunity under this proposed statute for rebuttal reports. So you're adding every step along the way additional discovery, additional expert time, which will require additional defense cost time from the point of the defense lawyer. There is no way around it. And if you ask any experienced defense lawyer who's trying medical malpractice cases in this state, and I would suggest that that number is somewhere around 12 lawyers. Not 12 firms, 12 lawyers. And they'll tell you that currently, today, their schedules are planned out through early 2004 with trial dates today. Those lawyers who are now going to be faced with exchanging reports, gaining reports, responding to reports, are going to have that staffed by someone. And that's going to be other lawyers, which are going to increase defense costs for the insurance companies that you've heard from. Similarly, on the plaintiff's side, it's going to increase the costs. But perhaps more importantly, it's going to invite more judicial time in our otherwise strapped court system. I had a long conversation with a circuit judge in Lane County who had hoped to be here today, Judge Lyle Valour. He couldn't come because one of his colleagues broke his leg, I'm told, unfortunately, Judge Merton. And Judge Valour authorized me to make his pitch, which is in opposition to this bill, for the simple reason that, as written, this would require exchange of expert reports in every type of civil case, including domestic relations cases, any type of case, and that will simply overburden what our judges are currently expected to do. Remember, if you create a statute that imposes deadlines, inevitably there's going to be motions to extend those deadlines. There's going to be oppositions to motions to extend the deadlines. That's going to require resolution by a judge. That's going to extend the trial date. That's going to further delay the disposition of these cases. That's why in my 23 years of experience, anytime this issue has come up, be it before the Council on Court Procedure or this body, it's been rejected. Time and time again, it's been addressed. And I continue to believe, and I submit if you check with colleagues around of mine, you will find that the system we have is a good system and it doesn't need to be fixed. The last thing I would add with regard to this rule relates to judicial economy. As Mr. Wobrock said, I've had an opportunity to try cases in other states, and I can tell you that in two cases I tried in the state of Idaho that have this rule, both cases went up on appeal after defense verdicts, that is, verdicts by juries in favor of the defense in that case, both Doctor. Cases, my clients, the physicians. Both cases were appealed by the plaintiff on the grounds that my expert disclosures were not sufficient. Each case, first before the Idaho Supreme Court and the other one in front of the Federal District Court in Idaho, took an additional 2 years to resolve. Simply on those issues alone, and the defense prevailed in both cases. So for those very practical reasons, I'd suggest to you that this bill is ill-advised and unnecessary, and I'd entertain any quick questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. We're going to go ahead and finish up with Ms. Ironman, because I'm going to start to lose committee members here, as evident by the representative from Dallas stepping out right now. So Ms. Ironman, please.
Thank you, Representative Williams, members of the committee. My name is Linda Ironman. I'm an attorney from Portland, a small three-person law firm. I have 26 years of practice, and we represent people who are injured by defective products and medical malpractice. And I'm here today to speak against House Bill 2493, both on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and on behalf of my clients. The proponents are correct by saying that what they're trying to do is bring the federal standard into the Oregon rule. What you need to understand is that the federal standard was just enacted in the year 2000, and the process of enacting it was highly controversial. There was questions about whether it should be enacted and whether what language should be used in the actual text of the bill. There were compromises over words. And since it's been enacted, there have been many, many appellate cases and law review articles written about what does this language mean and how should it be applied to the facts of any given case. I don't have time to talk to you about all of the substance of that controversy, but there are three Oregon points that I want to raise because I think it's particularly ill-advised to import this new and controversial federal standard into Oregon. The first point I want to make is that this bill does not have really anything to do with the problem you're trying to solve for the doctors. The doctors, I understand, need stable and affordable insurance premiums. But scientific evidence is not an issue that comes up in medical malpractice cases. Mr. Hoffman told you that he does aviation and products liability cases. And where these issues come up are in toxic exposure cases, like breast implants, and they come up in criminal prosecutions. And the leading cases that we have in Oregon on scientific evidence, three of them are criminal prosecution cases involving polygraphs, a type of field sobriety tests for drunk driving, and the third one is a type of DNA testing. And the fourth case is the breast implant case that Mr. Hoffman mentioned, a toxic exposure case. With the issues, the cases involving medical malpractice, scientific evidence simply, I can't think of a case where it ever came up. I won't say it never does, but it would be extremely rare. And so when I heard this bill had been submitted by the Oregon Medical Association, I called Mike Schrunk, the district attorney up in Multnomah County. He wasn't even aware of it at that time last week. And I called the dean of the University of Oregon Law School, who had been on the federal committee that studied the change in the rule, and he wasn't aware of it. So what I'd like to say is if you're considering this rule, it's not part of the medical malpractice crisis, and there's no crisis that would make you need to rush into enacting it. And I think it's a big change in Oregon law, and I think if you're going to consider it, you need to take your time. That's my first point. The second point I want to make is that Oregon has a well-established and effective procedure and approach to the admissibility of scientific evidence. It has been since 1984 when the first landmark case was written by our Oregon Supreme Court. There has been a traditional approach taken by the Oregon courts, which says basically the admissibility of scientific evidence is determined the same way as the admissibility of other evidence, which is you follow the rules of evidence in the Oregon Evidence Code. And in my written testimony, I've outlined the points that the judge, as gatekeeper, is required to follow before scientific evidence can be admitted in Oregon. First, the judge determines if it's relevant under Rule 401. Next, the judge decides if it provides some assistance to the trier of fact under Rule 702. And the cases say that what providing assistance means is the subject of the testimony must be within the expert's field, the expert must be qualified, and the foundation for the opinion must intelligibly relate to the testimony, relate the testimony to the facts. And finally, if the evidence meets those, then the court looks to see if it's unduly prejudicial or repetitive or should be excluded for some other reason. We have a 20-year history of case law which has adopted this traditional approach, and it's working fine. There is no crisis in this state of junk science or the things that we hear from other sources. Also, the way that I think of this, it's hard to illustrate the difference between the reliability standard that the proponents of this bill want and that's written into the federal statute and what we have in Oregon. But I think that Representative Prozanski alluded to it earlier when he suggested, is it the judge or the jury that you want to decide ultimately if the evidence is to be accepted, not just admitted into court for consideration, but accepted. And under our approach, the judge decides if it's a case about beef. They decide, is the evidence about beef, is the witness qualified to talk about it? But they don't decide how beefy is it. And in the, under the federal rule, that's what they're doing. And every judge who makes a decision on that is making a different decision because it's how beefy is it to them rather than leaving that to the jury. That's not a great example, but it's trying to get the point across. There are also significant, I think, fiscal impacts that would come about if this bill were passed, because for those of us who have followed the path in the federal courts since the Daubert opinion was decided 10 years ago, we have seen that in almost every case involving expert witnesses, with the possible exception of medical malpractice, the defense side will make a motion before any witness testifies, and the plaintiff side will have to go through the hoops of establishing the reliability of their witness's methodology. There are many, many experts who do not need to be put through the hoops under those circumstances. Court workloads, if this bill is adopted, in both civil cases and, I believe, in criminal prosecutions, will skyrocket, and the costs of litigation will also increase as we have to go through these additional motions. The case that Mr. Hoffman alluded to that is an Oregon Supreme Court case, the breast implant case, these motions were made, this was several years ago when the Daubert in federal court was new and they were trying to import it to Oregon. These motions were made before every witness that was called at trial. It added an additional 2 weeks onto the time of the trial because each witness had to go through their testimony once for the judge and then once for the jury. At this time, when we have problems keeping our courts open, I don't think we want to increase the workload. But the real bottom line is that we have a system. It's working well. And we don't need to change it. If you're considering changing it, please don't do it in haste because it is a big decision as it impacts the admissibility of evidence, especially for injured people. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the really troublesome figures that we've got derived in this discussion about medical malpractice is the rather low proportion of the dollars that are paid in premiums that wind up in the hands of victims to compensate them. And it appears that a substantial amount of what's put into the system ends up being spent on advocacy on both sides of issues. I'd like a comment on both of the bills that you're testifying on, and I'd let anybody comment, although Mr. Miller may be in the best position to comment since he's been on both sides of the of these cases. Would passing either or both of these bills tend to reduce the cost of advocacy on both sides, or would it tend to increase them, or would the effect be neutral?
Well, there's no question it would increase them, and it would increase them significantly. And one need only pick a lawyer who handles cases in the federal court and a lawyer who handles similar cases in the state court and ask to see the bill. Which bill is more, the federal court or the state court bill? There won't be any question that given the discovery that's contemplated in the expert disclosure bill, coupled with the requirement proposed by 2493, would increase costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you're welcome, Representative. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your testimony. I want to apologize to those who we have not been able to get to today, given our time frame. I encourage you to work with Mr. Joseph. These bills will be back up tomorrow, and we'll attempt to do everything we can to ensure that everyone has an opportunity to testify on the bills that have been posted. With that, committee, we're going to adjourn for the afternoon.